Okay, so the plan really is to try to do two things today. The original schedule called for one lecture on the governing equations for the geodynamo, and the last called for a discussion of planetary comparisons, and we're going to try to do a bit of both. We can't do both in complete detail, but there is a theme, in fact, that connects these two together, and that is the fact that my premise that I'll just simply state, and we'll see whether or not you believe that it's true, is that the magnetic field and its persistence in terrestrial planets is a very good diagnostic of the internal evolution, in particular the convection, nature of convection, the mantles of those planets. And so therefore the fact that the Earth has a field, that Venus doesn't have a field, that Mars doesn't have a field, is really telling us something as much about the mantles of those planets as it is telling us something about the way in which the magnetic field gets generated. So this is the basic idea, that magnetic fields are really quite useful and I think informative diagnostics about the dynamics of the mantle. And so let's start with the dynamo problem. We'll spend maybe half an hour on this and then we'll switch to the planetary comparisons, which will really be all about stagnant lid, which is the way in which we think mantle dynamics works on these other planets. And in fact, I suspect explains why, in fact, we don't see fields on Mars or Venus. Okay, so we talked about we needed a certain amount of heat flow coming through the core mantle boundary to sort of produce the dynamo, and what I thought that we would focus most of our attention on is just what does the dynamo actually do with all that heat? Where does it go? How does it spend it? That sort of thing. And so if you imagine buoyancy being created at the boundaries of the fluid, either by thermal anomalies at the top or light elements at the bottom or latent heat at the bottom, driving convection, we can sort of think of that buoyancy in these boundary layers as gravitational energy. And the process of actually then having that stuff go unstable and drive fluid motion, giving us kinetic energy, is what we've been talking about in the context of convection. But then somehow, through processes that we're going to only scratch the surface on, somehow this kinetic energy gets converted into magnetic energy, and that process we're going to characterize as the dynamo process. But ultimately, regardless of where we put the energy, whether we put it into kinetic or whether we put it primarily into magnetic, ultimately these two sources of energy are going to be converted to heat, either by viscous losses or by ohmic effects. And we think that by virtue of the low viscosity in the core, that most of the energy that gets pumped into the system, ultimately by cooling the core, ultimately gets dissipated ohmically, and that relatively a little amount or small amount of this actually gets dissipated by viscous effects. It's exactly the opposite in the mantle. In the mantle, all of the gravitational energy that goes to kinetic ultimately also goes into heat as work done against viscous stresses. So the question then, in terms of the dynamo, is how do we actually get this fluid motion to generate a field? And so, again, there's lots of details as far as how this goes. Let's just sort of make a plausibility argument as to how this might work. The description is based on Maxwell's equations in principle, although the equations that you actually use in a low-frequency approximation, where you assume that the fluid motion is actually moving slowly relative to the speed of light, all the equations that you need to derive this equation here, and I've actually in the notes given you all the bits and pieces that go into making this, all predate Maxwell's equations. And so despite the fact that it came before Maxwell, we still describe them as pre-Maxwell. So it's a measure, I guess, of his influence on the field, obviously. So if you were to take those equations for the electric field, Faraday's equation, which was based on his public experiments of waving magnetic or wires through magnetic fields, Ampere's law, which relates the current to the magnetic field, and Ohm's law, which relates the current to the electric field, you can put those things together and get an equation that describes how the magnetic field evolves in response to fluid motions and also in response to ohmic effects, which actually dissipate the field and cause it essentially to diffuse away. And so if you didn't have this piece right here, essentially this would look a lot like a temperature equation with no heat sources, and you imagine if you had some magnetic field or some distribution of temperature without any source or generation, that field would gradually diffuse away. And in fact, it diffuses away relatively quickly. It depends on this diffusivity, which is 1 over permeability times conductivity. This number turns out to be about 1 meter squared per second. So in order to sustain a field for periods of time longer than a diffusion time, which is about 30,000 years, you need to be constantly regenerating the field by these fluid motions. And so if this is going to be successful and we're actually going to keep a field around for a long time, we need to make sure that this term is at least big enough relative to this term to do the job for us. And so if we were to just take the ratio of these two terms, the induction part here to the diffusion part here, construct sort of order of magnitude estimates about how big these terms would be, so dividing by L is the same as taking a derivative in this sort of simple-minded scheme, then you get this ratio VL length scale divided by the diffusivity, and in most models that number, which we call the magnetic Reynolds number, has to be bigger than zero. I don't think there have been any self-consistently convectively driven dynamo models that have actually been successful with these Reynolds number, this combination of numbers less than about 100. And so if you were to take nominal values for what we think fluid velocities, at least at the top are, typical length scales, diffusivities, you get a magnetic Reynolds number of about 100. So, okay, so far so good. Not a comfortable margin of error, but it looks like we're okay. And in fact, when you actually try to do this with the numerical models, what you find is that you tend to get slightly higher Reynolds number, magnetic Reynolds numbers for the present-day Earth, in part because, or suggesting perhaps, that the fluid velocities in the interior, which is the part that we can't see, might be a little bit higher than the ones that we see on the surface. So maybe in the Earth, the magnetic Reynolds number could be about as high as 1,000. This is all based on the dynamo models, which we'll see in a minute, still have a long way to go before we can really characterize them as being Earth-like. And maybe to just come back to the point that we talked about last time, if we have the thermal conductivity become too low, then this conductivity becomes low, the diffusivity goes up, and we start to get in danger of actually dropping below what the Rayleigh number, Reynolds numbers we need. Another point to make is that numerical models also suggest that this is kind of like the minimum that you have to ante in to be in the game. But if you want to have reversals, it seems that you have to drive the systems a little bit harder, and the magnetic Reynolds numbers have to be a little bit higher than 100. So that's also a thing. And we know the field reverses, and so it suggests that the field or magnetic Reynolds number in the Earth has to be a little bit higher than the minimum value. Yep? It does come from secular variation, so that reflects the velocities at the top. And the way in which these have been done in the past is to make a correlation between the secular variation timescale in the models that you see at the surface and the magnetic Reynolds number somewhere in the interior. And then when they scale that relationship to the Earth, they come up with numbers which are a little bit higher than what you would guess if you just use the surface velocities. Okay, so here's sort of the influence of flow on a field. If we're imagining that we're in this large magnetic Reynolds number limit, 100 would be considered large in fluid mechanics usually, 10 sometimes is considered large, but for about 100 we're pretty safe to say that to first order we can think of the influence of flow on a field as essentially being frozen, or the field rather being frozen to the fluid. And so if the fluid moves and stretches, the field lines essentially go with it. And this is kind of a nice intuitive conceptual idea for thinking about what happens. So if I've got some bundle of flux with some lines coming out of it here, and I impose some flow on it, which, say, takes that tube and essentially stretches it, it goes with the flow, essentially, and gets a little bit longer. I've got the same number of field lines in that tube, but now they're concentrated into a much smaller area. And if we think of the field as being how many field lines per unit area is giving us the strength, then what we've done by this process is by stretching this field line out, we've actually got a stronger field. Okay? So the fluid motions are essentially doing work to stretch this field line. And it does work because just you can also think of this like an elastic band. And almost you think of it as magnetic tension, really, I guess is more accurate. But the fluid motion actually has to do work to stretch this. If you let go, it would essentially snap back, in effect. And so the work that you're doing to actually stretch the field and increase the strength of the field actually requires work of the velocity against the Lorentz force, which is sort of the elastic tension in the line, if you like. And so this process is effectively going to be transferring kinetic energy from the fluid motions and then depositing it into the magnetic field. So some combination of stretching, and slightly more complicated than this, but certainly stretching is an essential ingredient to making this process work. Okay, so if we were to just take that induction equation and multiply it by B divided by this constant, which is permeability, which doesn't matter really, and integrate over all space, we get an expression for how the magnetic field energy changes as a function of time. So this is almost looks like a kinetic energy, really, where this mu is acting like a density, in effect. So we've got sort of magnetic energy here changing. That's just the sum of two parts. The work that the fluid motion is doing minus the amount of ohmic dissipation that we've got going. And so in a nominally steady state dynamo, we've got a balance then between the amount of work, the amount of transfer of energy from the fluid motions into the magnetic field being balanced then by the dissipation associated with current associated with that magnetic field. In the notes, it actually gives an equation for the relationship between J and B, so it's not going to be obvious unless you sort of look at that, but it's possible to convert this estimate for the dissipation, this J divided by the conductivity times the volume, to express it back in terms of the magnetic field. And so two points I think I want to make here is that if we were to pump in a lot more energy, let's suppose that the inner core nucleates were now providing all that compositional buoyancy, putting a lot more gravitational energy into the system, you might argue or might suspect that the amplitude of the field would go up. And people have published papers saying they see increases in the strength of the magnetic field, and that times the onset of inner core growth. But the problem is, it does in fact depend on the amplitude of the field, but it also depends on the length scale, the characteristic length scale of the field. And what seems to happen in these models is when you drive them harder, it's not so much that the field gets stronger, but rather the characteristic length scales get shorter. So you take the field, you drive it harder, and it just kind of crinkles up into smaller scales. And so it seems unlikely that we're going to get much information from surface variations of the field relating to how much or how hard we're actually driving this process. Okay. Let's turn now to the dynamics. And this is the other half of the story. So we've got one equation that says something about what fluid velocities do to the magnetic field. And you maybe have some notion that stretching field is a good thing. It turns out you actually have to diffuse the field to make this work. Just simply stretching without limit won't do it. But again, that's the key ingredient. All right, so here's the equation that we had last time for the mantle. We had inertia, the MA term, and then all the sum of the forces. And in the mantle convection problem, we considered pressure gradients, we considered viscous forces, and we consider the buoyancy, which ultimately is essentially the energy source, if you think of it that way. In the core, it turns out that inertia is actually pretty important, right? We tossed this guy away. We argued that this term was about 10 to the 24 smaller than these guys, and so could be neglected. The opposite is true in the core, just simply because the viscosity of the core is so low. So inertia is actually important. And what's more is that we can't neglect the fact that part of the inertia is the fact that the Earth is rotating. And so there are so-called pseudo-forces or pseudo-accelerations that we have to add to be part of the complete description of the inertia if we adopt a rotating frame. And that's the only sensible thing to do. We have Coriolis force and we have centrifugal force. We'll see later that this centrifugal force looks like a pressure, and we can sort of bundle it up into here and sort of just hide it out of the way. It doesn't really matter how we partition those two. So here's all the forces that we have in the context of the core. So we've essentially got inertia playing a much more important role. We've got Coriolis and centrifugal effects in there. These guys are all the same. Pressure, viscosity, buoyancy. And the only thing that we're adding is that force, that line tension that the fluid feels when it tries to stretch a magnetic field line. Okay. So what do we think about the relative orders of these guys? We can make ratios. We think that the dynamics of the core is kind of like the ocean. We think that rotation, Coriolis effects, are probably as big as anybody else in this equation. So it would be sensible in judging the size of relative terms to compare their magnitudes to the size of the biggest things we think are going to play a role. And so, for example, we've already seen that viscosity we think is a small term. If we divide it by the Coriolis force, and this has a name, Ekman number, I think he was an oceanographer actually. Again, order of magnitude scaling arguments, simplify it down a little bit, put in some numerical values, and you get a number of 10 to the minus 15. So what that's saying is that viscous forces are about 15 orders of magnitude smaller than the effects of the Coriolis force. So that's small, that's not infinity, but it's close to infinity, or 1 over infinity, I guess. The other term that we might want to think about is sort of these what I would call local inertia terms, like this guy or like this guy, which tend to sort of scale similarly. That in oceanography, they define that as a Rossby number, and our guess for the size of the inertia divided by the Coriolis force, rough order of magnitude estimate, this is the standard form of the Rossby number in oceanography, comes out to be about 10 to the minus 6. So these guys, accelerations, local accelerations in the rotating frame, those accelerations, or if you think of them as forces, are about a factor of a million smaller than the Coriolis force. Okay, so it's all, in all likelihood, you can't solve these equations numerically to that kind of accuracy. So very often you think about dropping these terms off and asking what's left over and just deal with the leading order part. Well, if the magnetic field turns out to be weak, and this is just a supposition at the moment, what gets left over is this equation, which is a balance between Coriolis force, pressure gradients, and the buoyancy. And this is just a geostrophic equation, which anyone who's done atmospheric science or oceanography knows, right? This is the weather map story. You have a pressure low, you have flow going around it. It's exactly the same equation. It's exactly the same physical processes. So in some sense, the core is a lot more like the atmosphere than it is that like the mantle. And again, that's because of the strong effects of rotation by virtue of the fact that the fluid has a very, very low viscosity. Okay, this is a really neat result. Taylor Proudman, depending on where you go to school, you learn this different ways. If you go to Cambridge, you learn there's Taylor Proudman, because G.I. Taylor was actually at Cambridge. He was the guy that also introduced dislocations, right? He was one of them. That's right, same guy, basically. Amazing character. Proudman was at the Oceanographic School, or Oceanographic Institute in England. And so if you learn this outside of Cambridge, you call it Proudman-Taylor. Okay, but it's the same thing, so don't be confused. If you learned it in Paris, perhaps there could be something different. I wouldn't doubt that for a second. Very possible. Okay, yep.
Why are we ignoring the Lorentz forces in this?
Well, because we're just hypothesizing that the magnetic field is weak. And if the field is weak, the current is weak, and the forces are weak. I'm not saying that that's true. I'm just saying let's consider that as a possibility. Okay? In fact, we think it's not true, and I'm going to explain why we think it's not true, but to justify that, you have to see what happens if it's not present. Okay? So its existence will be required by the consequences of its absence, I guess. Okay, so let's take the curl of this equation and then just look at the z component of it. I've done the algebra for you. It's just simply that some constants out here, the derivative of the vertical velocity with respect to depth is equal to zero. Okay, so I curl this and take the z component, that guy disappears, and that guy disappears because that has a z component. And what that means is that if the derivative of the vertical velocity with respect to z is constant, that must mean that vz is constant, right? Differentiate that, I get back to zero. But if the fluid velocity at the boundary here or here is equal to zero, then it's zero everywhere, okay? And so what that means is that if I had a buoyant parcel of fluid sitting in a geostrophic flow, it would like to rise, but it will not. It will just sit there. Weird, huh? This, I think, is shock and awe, if you ask me. And we could go through, if you're interested, we could talk about it later, how that works. But the bottom line is that if we want to have convection happen, we have to put something back. In other words, we have to add one of the forces that we've neglected, that we've argued is small, we have to basically put it back. And our two choices are either we put viscosity back in, or we put the magnetic field back in. Yep. Oh, sorry. In my notes, I actually have this. It doesn't matter, actually, but let's have it pointing down. But frankly, it doesn't matter, because whatever sign I choose for gravity, the z component, when I curl it, is going to disappear. It's along the rotation axis, right. If I do it in spherical geometries, I get the same result, but the details of the curl is harder to justify. Yeah?
If there were like a little Taylor Proudman demon to come and give it a push, mm-hmm. What would keep going?
Gosh, that's a good question. It's hard to say, because now what you're doing is you're asking me to impart accelerations to this, and this flow doesn't include those. My guess as to what would happen if you just simply gave this a bump and you restored the local inertia terms here, you would just generate inertia waves, and it would just sit there, and it would just vibrate back and forth. Okay? Yeah, it's great stuff. You gotta love rotating fluids. Okay, so here's the two choices, right? Viscous forces or magnetic forces. And so we've already said that the viscosity of the fluid is really low, right? So we know this term, I've just told you, this is 15 orders of magnitude smaller than the Coriolis force, right? So the only way that I can get this guy to play a role is by making this length scale really small. And that's exactly what happens. If you have a rotating fluid and it has no magnetic field and it has a low viscosity and you try to get it to convect, eventually it will convect because your fluid does have some velocity, or viscosity rather, but what you'll get is a very strange looking thing. So here's the weak field case, so the B field is out of the picture, there's no Lorentz forces in this problem. Convection absolutely requires on getting viscosity. Let me just put this back up just for a second. Essentially what adding either of these forces does is basically put something non-zero here, essentially. So either this or this will put something non-zero there and make that not necessarily zero. Yeah, what have I done? Okay. So here is the weak field solution, where the field is basically non-existent, or at least very weak, too weak to be important. The convection will absolutely require on viscosity. So you'll have no convection if the viscosity is zero. Start to introduce a bit of viscosity, and you'll actually start to get convection. Introduce a little bit more viscosity, and you'll get a little bit more convection. Again, very counterintuitive, I have to say. You tend to get columnar convection, which means that you get these sort of helical rolls which align with the rotation axis, but they absolutely have to be small scale. In fact, you can show, and again, if you were interested, we could actually work through the scaling argument to show that it's this Ekman number to the 1/3 times the height. In the core, that would be about 100 meters. And so you'd have these 100 meter, or probably a little bit less than 100 meter, Taylor columns basically extending across this million meter core. It's a hard thing to imagine, and it would be a nightmare to try to simulate that on a computer. It would be impossible. On the other hand, when we've done calculations with a strong magnetic field, what you find is that you also break this constraint, you get convection, you get columnar convection, but it's much larger scale. The sort of the sizes of these convective cells, not exactly, but are of order the depth of the fluid. So much, much bigger horizontal scale. And so the key points, I think, the key conclusions to draw from this are A, that the magnetic field has a very important influence on the flow, right? We add the magnetic field and we go from this state to this state. So the point is the magnetic field has a huge influence on the flow. But the point is that we need the right flow, the right type of flow, to be able to produce the magnetic induction to give us back the field. And so the point, or I guess the way you want to think about this, is we have to figure out how to configure the flow and the field in such a way that they work together and actually regenerate the field. And in some sense, that's the trick, or that's the secret, of trying to get dynamo models to work. Maybe just before we press on, we do actually see some evidence for these sorts of things in the surface fields that are extrapolated to the core mantle boundary. Because if you, say, have upwelling here and downwelling here, any region where you've got downwelling into the center of one of these tubes, by the frozen flux approximation, it's going to sweep field lines together, right? It's going to be sort of sucking everything in from around here, sweeping all the field lines in. So we would expect, by the arguments that we had at the beginning, to have strong patches in these regions where there's sort of influx. And in fact, you can argue, and the people that have constructed these models, like Jeremy Bloxham and Dave Govins, would argue, in fact, that that's exactly what you see in these fields. So here's an estimate of the magnetic field at the core mantle boundary. Maybe not so clear. I had to blow this up a lot. You can see it's actually a bit fuzzy. But they would point to these patches here, strong patch here, which is perhaps hard to see, and there's, trust me, another strong patch right here, right below it, like a column, right? And so that these are thought to then be strong patches, and these actually just sit outside the inner core. So they're kind of in the right place, doing the right things. So this gives us some confidence, again, that these big scales are, in fact, representing a dynamo state, which is, in fact, in the large, the strong field. Magnetic field plays an important role in the structure of the flow. Yeah, that's probably bigger than 100 kilometers, I would think. But yeah, big scale by comparison, 100 meters. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So what's the issue, and why is this so hard? The only other thing about the dynamo model is that it's not messy like the mantle dynamics problem. We know exactly what we have to solve. It's just that we can't solve it. That's the problem. And so this tries to illustrate, in other words, we don't have any funny rheologies we have to figure out. No one debates the equations. No one debates that at all. So it's really just a technical problem of how do you actually solve these equations. And if you think back just for a second to the Rayleigh number example that we had, and you guys that ran Rayleigh numbers of 10 to the 10th and got silly results because you weren't resolving the boundary layers. And so clearly, the issue with respect to numerical models is you have to have grids which are sufficient to resolve the features which are important. Okay? And the problem with the core is that we have both low viscosity and low thermal diffusivity, and these two things together permit very, very small structures to develop in the core. Again, the effects of viscosity we often characterize in terms of a Ekman number, which is 10 to the minus 15. If we think about what the viscous boundary layers are with respect with that number, we get a value of sort of e to the 1/2 times d, which is about 10 centimeters. If you wanted to resolve, of course you wouldn't do this, but if you wanted to resolve that kind of length scale through your entire core, you'd need probably about 3 million or 30 million grid points in radius. It's just not going to happen. The other point is the thermal diffusivity is also very small. This is also known as the Roberts number in these calculations, and it's defined in a dimensionless way as the diffusivity divided by the magnetic diffusivities. So this is thermal diffusivity, magnetic diffusivity. This is about order one. So these ratios actually take of order the values of these guys in SI units. And so again, this is a really small number. If we're thinking about composition driving convection, we're thinking about chemical diffusivities, then that's probably three orders of magnitude smaller again. Okay, where do we stand with respect to the models? Well, models have been able to go to about 10 to the minus 5 reliably without doing tricks. And they tend to run about Q of 1, although often people run these with Qs of 10 because they run much easier. And so the question is, getting, say, 10 to the 5, 10 to the minus 5 instead of 10 to the 15, or using Q equals to 1 rather than 10 to the minus 6, are we getting close enough? And the current suggestion is, well, I mean, the field looks reasonable. Whenever you hear people talk about these things, they say, wow, you know, we get a really nice dipolar field. Some of the higher multipole components look about reasonable. But are they really realistic? And we think the answer is probably no. And a couple of points, I guess, that sort of come to mind is, in most of these calculations, the viscous dissipation is comparable to the ohmic dissipation, which is not what we expect. In fact, we expect the ohmic dissipation to be almost the dominant or the entire source. And so when people estimate ohmic dissipation, they're throwing away half the dissipation, so it's not really clear that you're getting reliable numbers. The other point is the dynamical regime. We have some expectation about what the important forces are. We think, for example, that magnetic fields are important. And so you would expect, if you took the magnetic field out of a calculation and continued to time step it, the solution for flow would be completely different. And in some of these calculations, especially the earlier ones, when they did that experiment, the flows don't change at all, which is basically telling you that viscous effects are playing way too big a role and that 10 to the minus 5 is still not close enough. We may not have to go all the way to 10 to the minus 15, but we're not close enough yet to get all the way there. So one of the things that you can do is you can actually try to take a little chunk out of the core. This would be Stan's argument. Take a chunk out of the core and ask the question, what's happening in that little chunk? And this is my picture of what probably the core looks like at small scales. This is a numerical simulation with rotation going in this direction. There's an imposed magnetic field in this direction. And it's about a 10 kilometer by 10 kilometer cube. You get these tiny little eddies. Sort of typical spacing between these sort of plate-like eddies is something on the order of maybe 100 meters or so. So very, very small scale stuff. This is almost entirely ohmic dissipation. If you ask how much ohmic dissipation versus viscous dissipation in this calculation, the viscous dissipation is almost a factor of 1,000 smaller. So really, it's this sort of, in some ways, confirms the fact that really ohmic dissipation is the whole game. And in fact, trying to understand what this does to the big scale, I think, is actually the major challenge in actually getting these models to be more realistic. Okay. These are spectral because it's periodic. It's just a little chunk and periodic repeating, sort of the same kind of things that happen in the right.
Is this based on this ohmic dissipation?
Yeah, so what we're saying is that, here's how I would put that. What those efficiencies essentially do is, if we calculate a model for the thermal evolution of the core, then I can calculate what the buoyancy flux is at the boundaries. Okay? And I know that all the buoyancy flux that I feed into this system ultimately works its way and comes out as heat. So all I'm doing is calculating what the input is and saying that must be what's coming out the other side. Does that make sense? So I don't need to know the details of how this actually goes through. I don't need to know what the length scales of that are. I simply need to know that I'm pumping buoyancy in from the boundaries at a given rate, and that will be dissipated as heat. But what's important, I think, is the fact that these small scales actually dissipate probably maybe as much as half of the heat. So half of that energy, the work that I'm putting into this thing, is probably going into small scales that does absolutely nothing for me in terms of producing the big scales. And maybe only one half of the energy then goes into producing things like the dipole. Yep? I wasn't planning on it. I mean, there's generally an argument that the presence of an inner core tends to reduce the rates of reversals, and this is actually seen. But it actually is seen only up to a certain point. It seems once the inner core gets beyond a certain size, you actually get what some people call as the anti-Hollerbach effect, who is the person that first proposed this in the first instance, and it actually seems to get worse. So it's something that seems to be appropriate for today, but maybe not for the future. All in the boundaries. Why not? Because people debate, and I think the arguments aren't so clear-cut. I mean, it makes sense, and this is what Jeremy has done, right? But there are consequences for doing that, and he makes his inertia much more important as a consequence to get reasonable time-stepping. And so which is the greater of the two sins? I don't know. So it's just not that clear-cut. Okay. Yeah. How should I say this? Inertia is 10 to the minus 6 relative to everything else. Those experiments are driven with propellers, essentially. They're very interesting experiments, but they're not relevant to the Earth. That's what I would say. I'm not sure. They're probably fun to do, and they're dangerous to do because they do them in big liquid sodium, 2 meter, 1 meter, now they're going to 3 meter apparently. These guys have to be wired directly into the fire department. But I just don't think they're going to tell us anything about core dynamics. This turbulence, which I've called, is not inertial turbulence, it's convective turbulence. Well, I would look at it from a different point of view and say, for example, I don't think we need to get to 10 to the minus 15 to have this work. So maybe 10 to the minus 7 will work. Maybe 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9. That's still 5 orders of magnitude bigger than what we think. So in some sense, for that particular parameter, the mineral physics is irrelevant, right? It's just the fact that it has to be small, and we can't get it small enough in the code to get it right, to get the physics right. Yep. Sure. I mean, I think reversals are basically a consequence of driving the system harder than you need to. So in other words, imagine mantle convection going from steady laminar flow. You drive it a bit harder and it goes time dependent. I think the reversal phenomenon is almost exactly the same as that. You drive these things at first with low magnetic Reynolds numbers and you basically get fixed polarity. You drive them a little bit harder and you start to get reversals. So in other words, you're just producing perturbations in the flow which allow you to hop from one state to the other. The thing about reversals is if I had a numerical code that was chugging along and I just everywhere instantly changed the magnetic field to the opposite sign and took the next time step, the code wouldn't know the difference. It exactly cancels out. And so these are just two completely equivalent states, and I think if you get fluctuations which are large enough, you can imagine hopping from one potential well to the other and back again. And so you just have to have enough variability in the flow to essentially get over that activation energy. Supercrons, well, I mean, I could tell you what I think. It could be the mantle, but it might not. The argument is that it's mantle control. Stratified layers, for example, is a popular idea with maybe only me, but I like it. Yeah, it's pretty hard to do. I mean, it goes back. I don't know where it really starts to peter out. You could imagine that you start to lose resolution once you've lost oceanic crust, I guess. And I think, yeah. And so the fact is, beyond that, I think we don't have a very good record. So what we see is kind of reversals at sort of 5 to 7 per million years. It goes to 0 during this Cretaceous supercron and then comes back. So okay, we can do this. My idea, remember we talked about a stratified layer before, and the heat flow can go subadiabatic, right? And you get this stratified layer, and then the heat flow can come back up, and the layer can disappear. I imagine, and you can do simulations to show that this is not unreasonable, that you can actually grow that layer, actually at the time, using the plate motions and imposed plate motions, you can actually grow that layer to its maximum extent at the time when you expect the super Cretaceous supercron. So the idea is that it's almost like the inner core effect, right? You've got a layer of conducting fluid which is static, you've got magnetic field variations underneath, and it's kind of screening. And so if you think of reversals as the extreme of secular variation, then you're suppressing variations. So it's kind of like the topside Hollerback effect, I guess we could call it. Yeah. I think the answer is yes.
All the way back.
So, I mean, they have, yeah. I mean, there you don't know anything about the reversal frequency. All that you find is opposite or the other, right? And that the answer is yes. And in fact, you would expect that, right? Because you'd expect that the planet cools, it would be driving the system harder. So if we've got reversals now, we're almost certainly driving it harder earlier. So we almost certainly had reversals earlier. That would be sort of my take.
Sorry, I know you want to go on. But, you know, in turbulence, the whole point is, the cascading energy with all that scales, right?
Right.
And so that means that you are also dissipating the heat at all. Like,
yes.
Right?
Yes. And this is actually a huge contribution to that sink. And it actually does almost nothing for you in terms of generation because it's too small scale. Magnetic Reynolds numbers for these scale flows is probably 10 to the minus 4. Nothing's coming back from this.
So you did the same simulation on a 10 centimeter box?
No, would look different. Because at that point, now you're starting to hit viscous effects. You're starting to hit the thermal diffusive effects. And that will sap it out. What's surprising to me is that I thought that these things would just crowd together until you actually hit the viscous limit. It's not what happens. They get damp. The spacing gets stopped before viscosity becomes important. I don't know why. Yeah. Okay, what I want to do now is I want to switch gears and talk about planetary comparisons. So I've got you set for thinking about the fact that we have a magnetic field. We heard last day that we need to draw heat across the core at a particular rate if we want to have a magnetic field. And so when we start doing planetary comparisons, it's kind of interesting because we think about the Earth as kind of like being normal. If you read any introductory geology textbook, you'll hear mantle convection, plate tectonics, just like a cup of water or a beaker of water sitting on a Bunsen burner, right? It's so obvious that that's what's going to happen. And that's so wrong. If you look at the other planets, it seems like they don't operate in plate tectonics. In fact, when you do numerical models, it's far easier to get this style of convection than it is to get plate tectonics. In fact, it's arguably that we haven't done that yet with numerical models. And it's no coincidence, I don't think, that neither of these planets, which don't operate in plate tectonics, neither of them have internally generated fields at present. And these two, I think, are connected. And they're connected because stagnant lid, which is the way in which we think these other two mantles behave, almost guarantee that we can't get enough heat out of the core. And so what I wanted to do in the last 15 minutes or so is go through the scaling arguments that are based on some numerical calculations and a little bit of physical insight as to guess how these systems ought to behave. And so the picture is that if you've got really temperature-dependent viscosity and you're up in the boundary layer, it's going to be so cold and that stuff's going to be so stiff that it's basically not going to be moving, okay? So we have this layer which is absolutely immobile, does not move, okay? So the temperature profile that we get through that non-moving layer is basically just a conductive profile, right, for a static material. And then we get into the region where the viscosity becomes low enough that we can actually have convection, and then we have some low viscosity region where we have convection taking place, maybe with some small boundary layer down here at the bottom. And so maybe one way you want to think about this, and it's not a bad way to think about this, is it's almost as if we have sort of regular convection happening down here underneath a fixed boundary. So rather than having a free surface at the top, we just impose a top boundary here, and maybe we only have to worry about the part from here down, in a sense. And so the fact that this is solid, who cares how far it continues to extend out? Sort of. Okay. So the types of viscosity that typically go into these calculations are these exponential forms. Oh, what I should say is that in the notes, I think we go through an energetic argument for why the Rayleigh number to the 1/3 should be the boundary layer thickness. Remember that scaling argument we did before? So the next two or three pages is just another derivation of that using energy arguments, and not surprisingly, it comes out the same. This one, I think, this derivation is probably, in my opinion, a bit more solid than the scaling arguments that we talked about, but you get the same result either way. Okay, so the temperature-dependent viscosity is going to have this form. We'll have a certain viscosity at the top where the temperature is zero, and then the viscosity will plunge as we go into the interior as the temperature goes up. And so the thing is, before, we had only a Rayleigh number. Remember? We went through the calculations, everything drops out, we get one dimensionless parameter. But we've introduced some new physics here. We've said that viscosity is a function of temperature, so there's additional parameters that we would require to describe this system. And so we introduced this dimensionless parameter here, which is the product of this exponent, the sort of temperature dependence, if you like, times the temperature drop effectively across the layer. But as we'll see, this temperature drop across the mobile lid is pretty close to the temperature drop across the whole thing. So we'll be a bit ambiguous about which of those two we mean. We'll use different contexts and different applies. We can check this with numerical models. Okay. So there's our second dimensionless parameter. Clearly depends on no units at all. And the point is that when this number is really big, this layer is going to be immobile. It's going to have some thickness, which we'd like to be able to determine, and then figure out how effectively this can get heat out. Okay. So we're going to define a temperature gradient in this layer, which is just simply the temperature jump across the layer, or almost across the bottom, divided by the thickness of this thing. And I don't know what that is yet, but that's a pretty reasonable approximation for the gradient. And then the interior, we're going to have some sort of well-mixed, homogenized temperature, and we're going to have some viscosity in the interior that characterizes that well-mixed region. Okay, so let's see how this works. So what I want to do is I want to characterize how the temperature changes as I go from Ti up into this layer, right? It's just going to depend on what the temperature gradient is and then how far up I move into that layer, right? So it's just the gradient times delta Z. And therefore, the viscosity as I move up into that layer is going to be the viscosity here plus then the increase in viscosity as I increase through this temperature change, right? So it's just going to be the viscosity in the interior times this exponential form, gamma delta T grad T delta Z. And it's positive, of course, because I'm going back into lower temperatures in this scheme. So the point is, I've got an estimate for how the viscosity increases as I move into the layer as a function of the depth. That's the only thing that you have to take away from that. And so, I impose some stress on the top of the lid, so I've got convection happening in the interior. It's imposing stresses on the base. That stress will impose some strain rate, so I'll induce some flow. And I know that the flow for at least the Newtonian fluid is basically just the stress divided by the viscosity, gives me the strain rate. And I know that the viscosity is increasing, basically, as I go into the interior. So therefore, the strain rate must be decreasing as I go into the interior. And there must be some point when I've gone a certain distance that effectively the strain rate goes to zero. I'm going to say that's how far convection is able to penetrate into this stagnant lid. And so here's the ad hoc part. The argument in the original paper has just simply said, let's suppose that once we've gone one E-folding distance, so once we've gone E to the minus 1, that's as good as zero. Okay? So you just say that this exponent is equal to 1, that's how far convection can penetrate into the interior. This could be 2, this could be 3, it could be 4. It doesn't matter what you choose. It's just saying that it's somehow related to some E-folding distance in. You basically say that's it. That's as far as it goes. And so if we accept that idea, we rearrange this and say the penetration, or this region that convection penetrates into the layer, is just essentially, so I rearrange this, it's 1 over gamma grad T. Remember, grad T was basically the temperature jump divided by the thickness of this layer. I still don't know what that is. And then this product of numbers was just my dimensionless parameter. So that the distance I penetrate in is basically this value divided by this parameter P, which is going to be a big number because I expect the temperature dependence to be very strong. And I can define a temperature variation that penetrates in as well. It's just, what am I talking about here? This is the temperature perturbation right here at that distance. So it's just basically 1 over gamma. In terms of P, it's just delta T over P. Okay. Now what are we going to do? We're going to say, right, so we've got this stagnant lid at the top. That's going to act like a rigid surface on the convection below. We've got some temperature jump that goes across this sort of rheological transition, and that's the temperature that's actually driving convection. That's the idea. And so you define this critical Rayleigh number, this Rayleigh number rather, that looks a lot like the usual one, right, that we've been talking about all last couple of weeks, but instead of the full delta T across the layer, we're just taking the delta T across this rheological transition. Okay? And it's related to the Rayleigh number that you would get based on the viscosity interior, just divide it by P. So work through the details, you'll see you get that pop out. And now we just go through as if it's standard old convection inside a layer which has a rigid top. So for example, the thickness of the boundary layer at the bottom, or inside this rheological transition, basically goes as this Rayleigh number to the 1/3. Or in terms of the internal value, basically I have this factor of P appearing based on that definition. So the heat flow through this whole system is equal to essentially this temperature jump across the boundary layer thickness at the bottom, or this temperature drop across the stagnant lid at the top. And those two have to be the same, because as much heat as I'm pumping in the bottom, I have to be taking out the top. So these two guys are the same. A little bit of algebra, recognizing that this delta TRH is basically delta T by P. Rearranging, I get an estimate for the thickness of that boundary layer at the top. It almost looks the same as what we've had before, right? Here's the Rayleigh number to the -1/3 power based on the internal viscosity. That factor was like from before, but now we have this additional piece, which is P to the 4/3, that determines the thickness of that boundary layer. And so we could, in fact, in principle, if we wanted to construct parameterized convection models, you could use this then to run parameterized convection calculations for Mars, for Venus, compare them to Earth. But the real takeaway message that I want you to have is just how does this compare with the standard old isoviscous case that seems to work perhaps surprisingly well for the case of the Earth, where we take that whole boundary layer and just subduct the whole thing back down to the Earth. Okay, here's the punchline. Q in both cases is just K delta T across the layer divided by the thickness of this layer. In one case, we've got a normal thermal boundary layer, isoviscous. In the other case, we've got a thicker stagnant lid. In the isoviscous, it's given by this expression. In the stagnant lid, it's given by this expression. We take the ratio of these two guys, stagnant to iso, depends on this 1/4 power of P. There's the original definition of P plugging in there. And so let's see if we put in some mineral physics values for this, what do we get? Well, gammas range roughly from maybe 1% to 2%. This delta T just simply corresponds to the temperature jump across the top boundary layer for mantle convection. And if we do that, put it into this ratio, we get a factor of 1/40 or perhaps 1/100. So a substantial difference, right? And so if you think back about what we were getting out of the mantle, we were getting maybe 6 to 12 terawatts. And we knew that about 5 to 6 terawatts is being conducted by just conduction. So if we were to take the mantle and make it less efficient by a factor of 40, or make it less efficient by a factor of 100, the amount of heat that you're going to take out of the core falls well, well below what you need to actually drive the dynamo. And so the fact that stagnant lid convection on Mars and on Venus produces no magnetic field should come as no surprise. And I think this is true even if you had an inner core, which is often the argument. Well, Venus doesn't have an inner core, and you sometimes hear that, well, any day now the inner core is going to start to crystallize in Venus and we expect something to snap on. I doubt it. because ultimately you can only get a dynamo if you cool the core. You don't grow the inner core if you don't cool it, and this isn't cooling it fast enough to get the dynamo to go. So it comes back to my original point, and that is that, again, the dynamo and the existence of a magnetic field provides a really nice constraint. Not a unique constraint, but a very nice constraint, in some ways kind of a tight constraint, really, on what the dynamics of the mantle of these various planets can be. And we see that more clearly when we start making these planetary comparisons, which has, I think, for our SETI community, actually a lot of relevance and value. So,
there. No,
does anybody worry about that? Yeah, they probably do. I mean, the standard argument is that there's no liquid water, right? The water's gone. Too hot. Well, the argument is that you need water to make plate tectonics, because you need water to make this low viscosity asthenosphere and to make plate boundaries weak and to allow this whole thing to happen. The models that have been most successful at producing plate tectonic behaviors are ones that have plastic behavior, plastic yield characteristics in the plate itself, and a low viscosity asthenosphere. And so the thought is that the asthenosphere is essentially got a lot of water in it. It kind of lubricates the base of the plates. The yield stress criterion then allows us to exploit that and produce plates. If that doesn't happen, the argument goes that you lose the ability to create subduction zones, produce plates, and you get stagnant lid. Yes. Well, but at the top it's not. It's absolutely not. It's absolutely immobile. Right, so it's cold enough and viscous enough that it's just basically not deforming. So in other words, nothing's moving on the surface, and all the action is below it. Now you can have intermediate cases. If that I make that gamma parameter a little bit smaller, I can get into the sort of intermediate trans regime where the surface is in fact deforming a little bit, and they call that transitional sometimes. But for strong enough viscosity contrast, you know, we can run sitcom and see there's no fluid motion on the top surface, no motion at all. Yeah, Penny.
Mars just being inherently smaller than the Earth, never accumulated enough. One doesn't have much sort of primitive, you know, gravitational potential energy as well as where you are.
That's possible. It's possible, but I. Yeah, I mean, the argument about Venus, I mean, Mars had a magnetic field that appears, right? And so there's two lines of argument for this, and one that's been proposed by Dave Stevenson and Francis Nemo is that, well, you had liquid water on Mars, you had plate tectonics, and then you had this transition to stagnant lid once you had dehydrated. But it's equally plausible that, sure, stagnant lid's not as good, but back when you had a really, really hot Mars, maybe it was enough, the Rayleigh number, in other words, the Rayleigh number was high enough in stagnant lid to overcome this, and you did get enough heat out. And then it's just cooled off, because it's a smaller planet, you fall below this critical heat flow that you need to sustain a dynamo, and it just stops. So all of these are possible.
So, like, and also in Venus, people say this, but, well, Insu is also slightly smaller than
that. A little bit. And that's the argument for why it doesn't have an inner core. Sure. What I would say it's probably not is it's not related to the inner core, which is the standard assumed value now or assumption now. Where does it go?
What would happen to
Oh, I mean, I guess it would just bounce back, right?
If you.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the glib answer would be to say where it's hot enough, it will ductily deform, and where it's not, it will fracture, right? So you could imagine bouncing back could, in fact, produce fractures, I guess. I don't know. It's a good question, though. Yeah, that's a strange one. Yeah, that's for sure. Mercury is my kind of planet because it's basically all core all the time. You know, the argument about Mercury is that, I mean, often the argument that you hear about Mercury is that, well, you know, it was closer to the sun, it was hotter, we precipitate out a lot more iron relative to silicates, and it just grew that way. It seems that at least the cosmochemists tell us that that's not possible. And so what happened, it seems, to Mercury is that as it's being bombarded, because it's a little bit smaller, the crust, which is being bombarded, vaporizes the silicon, it gets blown out into space. And you just basically erode the planet down. So you've got this tiny little crust, or mantle, I guess is what it is. I mean, it's very small. I mean, it's 90%, 80% core, right? So it's small. I mean, eventually where these things go, if an inner core does exist in Mercury, it's probably got enough sulfur accumulated into the fluid part that you wouldn't freeze the whole thing up. That's sort of the standard argument. And if you had some radioactive heat sources, maybe you could have this slowly overturning, because again, maybe even just conducting enough heat through the crust would be good enough to do the job for you, right? But that's a curious one. It's clearly not, it's not a real booming field, right? I mean, it's just barely above detectable in the background of the other fields that are in the solar system. But it seems that it is convecting. And so somehow, by virtue of its large size, or by virtue of the fact that it only has a very thin mantle, which is regulating the heat flow out, it's able to convect enough to produce this field. Yeah, that's a neat one. Yeah. Sure. And yeah, but they worry about this, and that was the original argument about this. My understanding is that that's not the case, but presumably once MESSENGER gets to Mercury, we'll probably know the answer to that. I mean, this is the case with some of the satellites of the Jovian planets. There are some that clearly have induction, like Europa is an example, where you've got this apparently salt-rich liquid of ocean underneath the ice, and you can see magnetic induction effects from that. And they can tell that that's different, that's being induced by the field of the Jovian planet, as compared with Ganymede, which seems to have an internally generated field. And that's the one that's really puzzling, because it's so small, right? And you think it would just cool off very quickly and that would be the end of the story, and yet it seems to have an internally generated field that looks not like what you would expect from just straight induction in the post field that's produced by the Jovian planet. So, yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case for Io, right? But I'm not sure that there's enough energy to do it. And frankly, tidal heating's not a very good way to do it. And you can think of this as because all the tidal heating is going into the mantle, right? And so people have tried to do this, and you can actually get the models to work. But frankly, when you think about it just from a thermodynamic point of view, I wonder if the models work because the models aren't so good, actually. If you had good models, it wouldn't work, right? But basically, you're pumping heat in and taking heat out at the same level. There's no thermodynamic efficiency, basically. You're putting in and taking out at the same temperature. Just doesn't seem likely to me. Yeah. Only to the extent that there's limits on the remnant magnetism in the crust, right? I think the answer is yeah. We think that it's in the state that it only has remnant magnetization on the crust. Yeah. And that the magnetization is so strong, right, that one of two things had to happen. Either the field on Mars was huge as it's going through this sort of early burp in its history, or for some reason the layer of magnetizable material in the crust is much, much greater than what it is on Earth. And so this is actually still a source of some concern, because the anomalies are huge by our Earth-like experience, and so it's not clear what that means. Is it the recording device, or is it the source of the magnetization? And the answer is, I think we don't know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so every 500 million years or something, it resurfaces. So, yeah, you could imagine, for example, that every 500 million years, there's a burst of activity, right? And so maybe these guys are right. Maybe, you know, next couple of weeks, it'll get a burp and it will overturn. The problem is the surface is probably too hot to record any of that. Once it disappears, you turn off your energy supply for it, the field disappears in, say, 30, 40, 50 million years, or thousands of years, 40,000 years, but there is no surface record of that event. So we'd have to just be lucky to see it. right? Stranger Things. Actually, it's funny, you know, when they were having the flybys, right? And they went by Uranus, and Uranus was strange, right? Because the axial dipole is kind of on a strange angle. They said, well, that's pretty strange. Maybe we're just going by as it's reversing, right? And then it went by Neptune. It was on an angle. What's the chances of two reversals happening on the same trip, right? It's just a different way of operating, right? It's probably a more superficial generation process than one that's deep in the center. Okay? Good? Okay, thanks.